If you're charged with a crime and you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you. That's a right guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution because in our judicial system, we're supposed to be presumed innocent. But in Missouri, critics say the state's public defender system isn't doing its job. They say defenders are overworked with a caseload that makes it hard, if not impossible, to give each case the time and resources it really requires. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be discussing what's going on with Missouri's public defender system, starting with a Kansas City man who says that system put him in prison for life. Jeremy Bernfeld has the story.
Ricky Kidd has already been in prison for nearly half of his 42 years.
From day one, I've been claiming, screaming, kicking, fighting that I'm innocent.
Kidd was convicted of killing two people on Kansas City's east side, and his conviction was upheld on appeal. I spoke with him at a prison complex in Cameron, Missouri.
I guess I was a little naive early on. I thought that the system would have a quicker self-correct mechanism, and 20 years later, I'm still here.
20 years in prison. But now, the Kansas City-based Midwest Innocence Project has taken up Kidd's case. A key argument his new lawyers are making? Kidd never had a fair trial because his public defenders didn't actually mount a reasonable defense.
I did not have my day in court. I did not have a ton of evidence presented to the jury that would have clearly, most likely, altered the outcome of that verdict.
Here's just some of what Kidd claims. His state-appointed attorney failed to investigate the state's key witness. She didn't provide details for Kidd's own alibi. She failed to correct the record when an attorney incorrectly asserted that Kidd's prints were on the getaway car. Later, a federal judge even said from the bench that Kidd had, quote, really poor representation.
My case is a direct result of inadequate funding and management of a lot of our public defender systems around the country.
Missouri's system has been under intense criticism for decades. Report after report from as far back as the 90s says it's among the worst in the country at providing the right to counsel guaranteed in the Sixth Amendment.
It's a bit of a sham to say that we're complying with the Constitution in Missouri.
Tony Rothert is the legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri. The group brought a class action lawsuit earlier this year against the state. It says Missouri's public defender system is chronically underfunded and understaffed.
Every time someone's convicted and has a public defender, you have to wonder if the result would have been the same if they had adequate representation.
The state has yet to formally reply to the suit, but has contended in the past that it devotes as much money as it can to defend those who can't afford it. Public defenders in Missouri typically handle nearly 80,000 cases a year, from shoplifting to murder. But the office employs fewer than 400 lawyers.
And so people can fall through the cracks. And the people that fall through the cracks are people like Ricky.
That's Trisha Bushnell. She's one of Ricky Kidd's attorneys and the director of the Midwest Innocence Project.
They're people of color. They are people who come from disenfranchised neighborhoods. They are people who don't have the resources to hire the best counsel that they can get. And they pay the price for our mistakes.
And that, Bushnell says, is what happened to Kidd.
The problems in these cases that people struggle with is how could it happen? And, you know, here lightning struck twice. He had poor representation over and over again.
The Missouri Attorney General's office is fighting to keep Kidd in prison and declined to comment on the case. But a Jackson County Circuit judge recently granted Kidd a new hearing to determine whether he's being held unlawfully. She could order a new trial, or she could set him free. Or she could deny his motion and send him back to prison.
Well, can you introduce us to where we are right now?
We're at Crossroads Correctional Center here in Cameron, Missouri.
When I went to interview Ricky Kidd at the state prison that has become his home, he was upbeat.
I want to believe that at the end of the day, that we have a justice system that can will itself to do the right thing. And when I say a justice system, that means officials. That means prosecutors. That means judges. That means the powers that be. That they can will themselves to do the right thing.
The most recent budget approved by Missouri Governor Eric Greitens adds $1 million to the budget for public defenders, which would bring the allocation to about $46 million. That's about $25 million short of what the director of the system says it takes to adequately defend the people who have nowhere else to turn.
That was KCUR's Jeremy Bernfeld with In Conversation with Ricky Kidd. A new hearing of Ricky's case is scheduled to start next week. We're going to get into the larger issues with Missouri's public defender system in a minute, but let's talk to Jeremy Bernfeld because I want to know a little more about Ricky Kidd. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Gina.
So Ricky sounds like such a passionate guy. It's really hard for me to imagine maintaining that kind of spirited determination over 20 years in prison.
Yeah. I think passionate and determined, those are good words to describe Ricky. I've had the chance to speak with him many times over the year and a half or so that I reported this story. And look, it's a cliche that we see in movies and TVs, right? Someone goes to prison and they want to make the most of it as an opportunity. They want to fight the system. They want to proclaim their innocence. And in my reporting, I wanted to really push past that cliche. Like, you know, come on, 20 years in prison, how much determination do you really have? How much passion do you really have for this? And, you know, Ricky will tell you how he's changed his life. He'll tell you about the courses he took, the courses he's led. He writes poetry and plays. He'll talk frankly about some dark times that he's had, but I genuinely believe that he remains hopeful and determined.
What was his life like before he went to prison? What do you know about that?
Well, obviously, I wasn't there, and my reporting on that has, you know, relies honestly a lot on Ricky and some people who knew him at that point in his life in the 90s. I think one thing that he would say right off the bat, and he has said to me, is, you know, I was no angel. I think he felt like he would run with a crew that made a lot of bad choices, that he made a lot of bad choices. I think he was part of a tight-knit family group, but that family had many issues and was involved in drugs and all the issues that come along with that. So I think he, in talking with him, he's been very frank that he, you know, had a bit of a rough life, especially at that period.
You know, you said in your story that defenders assigned to Ricky's case didn't talk to key witnesses, didn't provide details of Ricky's alibi in court, didn't correct prosecution when there was a false assertion about fingerprints on a getaway car. Can you give us a little more detail on those oversights?
Sure. Let's talk about Ricky's alibi, because in my view, it's perhaps indicative of some of the issues with Ricky's case and how it connects to the public defender system in the state. So Ricky says that he went to his sister's workplace on the day of the murders, and that there are security tapes that would show him there. But by the time the public defender who is representing Ricky got really to work on his case, those tapes had been deleted and recorded over. So we can't know exactly what time this would have happened and exactly what would have been on those security tapes, because we don't have the tapes. And I think what to me was interesting was that this wasn't out of, you know, malice. Like, no one blocked the public defender, say, from taking a look at these tapes. The public defender wasn't out to you know, really dump on Ricky and not do her job. But it seems to me like if someone is overworked and they can't get to it in time, that these are the kinds of downstream real-world consequences to real people that do spring up.
What's your sense? I mean, it sounds like your sense of how this would happen is that just a person does not have enough hours in the day?
I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, everyone that I've spoken to, from people in the public defender's office, the head of the state's public defender system, to criminal justice researchers, you know, I think everyone has agreed that on the whole, public defenders are, you know, competent, hardworking, passionate about seeing justice done. You know, that's why they get into this in the first place. And so then the question becomes, is this a structural problem, right? Are the public defenders being set up to fail with the potential for really awful consequences for people, say, like Ricky?
I mean, I know that you're focused on Ricky's story, but did you happen to get any insight into that?
Well, look, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a criminal justice researcher. You know, there are a lot of really smart people who have spent years, you know, talking about this and trying to come up with solutions, and they are out there. I think there has been report after report by really respected groups, you know, for instance, the Committee of the American Bar Association, that really came in and took months to study the workflow and output and what the public defenders do. And they came up with some numbers that were really stark. I mean, just as an example, I don't have it quite in front of me, but I believe the committee suggested that public defenders should spend about 106, 107 hours on murder case to work on a murder case, that would be an effective thing to do. And they found at that point, this was 2014, they found that public defenders in Missouri spent 85 hours. So, you know, that's 20% or more less than
it would take to provide competent assistance. And this was, you know, across the state, and this was for obviously really difficult murder charges. So, I think report after report, I think the Missouri legislature has dealt with this, has tried to deal with this problem without much success, keeps pointing to the fact that there just aren't enough lawyers in the system to provide a competent defense.
Well, hang on for a second, Jeremy. Tricia Bushnell is with us from the Midwest Innocence Project, the group that's taken on Ricky's case. And Tricia, what's your sense of like structural flaws in the system?
I mean, there are absolutely structural flaws. I mean, as Jeremy is saying, it's a system currently that is set up to make people fail. And in listening, you know, to both to Ricky and to Jeremy, it's just striking how much it's a system that destroys good people. In both levels, it destroys families and defendants and folks who aren't being represented, and it destroys people who go into it with an intention of doing the best that they can, but never having the capability to do that.
But when you say set up to fail, what do you mean? Because I can't, I find it hard to believe, like intentionally set up to believe it was, or to fail. You know what I mean?
Well, so when I'm saying set up to fail, I mean we're chronically underfunding and overstaffing people, and that. As a system, if that's the way we're going to design the system, is set up to fail. It means that there is a disparity between the power of the state, who gets to bring all of its powers against a defendant, and the resources available to that defendant and the resources available to that defendant's team. Now, we could certainly decide that we want to fix that problem. We can certainly decide to fund it. We could certainly say, let's fund them equally so that the both sides have a fair shot. But that's a decision we have to make, and it's one that we've repeatedly failed to make. And so the question to me becomes, why is that? Why have we failed to do the right thing for so many folks?
So how does this play out? Ricky's case is one example, but what are some sort of common things that happen as a result of what you and others have described as a staffing problem and a funding problem?
Yeah, so the major thing is time. Right. So any case that is taken, and imagine if you were a defendant that was being prosecuted, what you would want your attorney to do. You'd want them to investigate. You'd want them to get all of the documents. You'd want them to read everything. And as currently set up, our system, the public defenders don't have that time, even though they want to. They don't. You know, Jeremy gave some statistics, but one of the ones I think is most interesting is the studies also show that on average, what a public defender has is 7.7 hours per case. And that's for every single case across the board.
And does that include, but I find this so hard to believe, that includes the time spent just talking to the client about what happened, like getting that person's side of the story? That seems like it would take at least a couple of those, 7 hours?
Exactly. It does. It includes death penalty cases. And so if you think about it, if the studies now are then saying that 85 hours are being spent on homicide cases, what's being spent on a robbery case? What time at all? Because we're averaging out to 7.7 and we're using 85 on a homicide case. So then folks down the line aren't getting any time at all. They're showing up, they're meeting their lawyers, and they're taking a plea deal. And that's what we're saying is justice, because we've set up the system to be this way.
The study that you and Jeremy are both referencing, it was called the Missouri Project, and it was conducted by the American Bar Association. And it really focused on attorney workload standards and comparing what is required to what attorneys were spending. And there are different categories, and you can look at it. There are really some shocking discrepancies between what the American Bar Association deems necessary and what Missouri public defenders are putting into each case. But why? I mean, why is this a particular issue in Missouri?
Well, it comes down to what we decide to fund. Right. If we are saying we aren't going to have enough money to staff people to do it, then there will not be enough people. Other jurisdictions have made different decisions than what we've done. Other states have decided different models. In California, for example, they have equal pay for prosecutors and for defense attorneys. So we're saying what you're starting at, your starting rate is the same. And the amount of money that goes towards board systems is the same. And we don't do that here. And they're questions for the legislature, but that also means they're questions for the public. And unfortunately, when we talk about the criminal justice system, we're talking about people that most people don't want to think about.
What kinds of things are defenders trying to fit into what it sounds like an average of less than 10 hours?
Well, talking to your client first, right? And think about that. Think about if you're a defendant, how often you would love to see your attorney. It'd be a lot, right? You'd want an update because you have no access to the outside world or anything else that's happening unless it's through your attorney. So talking to your client, keeping them updated, getting all of the evidence that the state has against them, getting all of those police reports, reading those police reports. I mean, in a homicide case, that's hundreds to thousands of pages, reading the forensic science, consulting with a forensic scientist to make sure that what their forensic scientist is saying is accurate or within the realms of science, and understanding it so you know what that means for the evidence against them, talking to witnesses that the police have already talked to or talking to people who haven't been identified, right? Tracking down records maybe from out of state, investigating if there's an alternative suspect, getting your own forensic testing, getting a psychological expert. I mean, there's just tons of things, and you're expected to do that in what we're now saying is, 7 hours.
Jeremy, did you get the sense from Ricky Kidd that his lawyer spent time doing these kinds of things?
Well, Ricky remains very, very frustrated on this point to this day. You know, when he was in jail awaiting trial, he actually complained and asked for a new lawyer. He felt like there's correspondence of him, really begging his lawyer to come back and talk to him more, to investigate certain areas, to move into different ways that he felt were just being ignored, and that's documented. So he certainly did not feel like he got appropriate representation. Now, of course, it's not hard to believe when you're in there charged with murder that you're going to be extremely freaked out and you're going to be extremely worried about this. So I'm sure that people, this relationship is going to be rocky no matter what. But from the beginning, Ricky has definitely been dissatisfied.
Tricia, once the initial defense misses opportunities to mount a strong case for someone's innocence, how hard is it to undo that damage?
It's incredibly difficult. The standards for review, the way that the courts are set up, is to value what we say is finality over fairness. We want the conviction to be done more than we want to continue to make sure that the outcome was fair. So there are all of these legal mechanisms that keep people in prison. You have to file by a certain date or time. You have to make sure you only file once. Everything you want in that filing has to be in at that time. And if you don't put everything in, then you miss the opportunity to raise something later. And unfortunately for Ricky, in one of his appeals that he filed on his own, and then a public defender was appointed to represent him in that, he raised a number of issues that we're now raising and saying these other things that should have been done, the alibi that should have been fully investigated, all of these different avenues. But that second public defender then dropped a number of those claims, just didn't continue raising them or pleading them to the court, so the court couldn't hear them. So that means that not only did he have representation that was inadequate the first time around at his trial, then he comes around to an appeal where he gets another public defender and they don't represent him adequately either. And unfortunately, those are really your two avenues to get into court. Once those are done, you have an opportunity for what's called a federal habeas, which he had, but the legal standards there are, again, very, very confusing and very, very high. And you don't have a right to an attorney there. So we talk about all these technicalities as what let people out, but in reality, technicalities are what keep people in. If it's not done correctly the first time around, attempting to fix that, particularly on your own with no resources while you're incarcerated, can't go investigate, can't go find those folks, is almost impossible.
Jeremy, when did you last speak with Ricky?
I spoke to Ricky last it's been a few weeks now. It's been a few weeks since I've actually spoken to him.
So how are his spirits going into next week's hearing based on your last time you spoke?
Well, I can certainly say, too, that Tricia is in a lot more contact with Ricky, I know, so she may be able to update us on that. But it should be no surprise, I think, to you and I, what we were saying at the top of this segment. Ricky, remained very hopeful. What came through to me the last time we spoke was how excited he was that he felt like he would actually get in front of a judge, which has been a long road for him. Tricia, there's way more backstory of his court segments that we could get into, but he's really excited about this one.
Jeremy Bernfeld, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeremy's the editor of Harvest Public Media here at KCUR. He brought us the story of Ricky Kidd, who will have the chance to appeal his case next week after 20 years in prison. When Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a former public defender who worked in Missouri's system. He'll tell us what this all looks like from the inside. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking this morning about Missouri's public defender system, the one that's supposed to ensure that everyone charged with a crime in the state has legal representation, whether they can afford a private lawyer or not. Critics, including the ACLU, which has filed a massive lawsuit against the state, say that the defense people receive through that system is inadequate. We've been chatting with Tricia Bushnell of the Midwest Innocence Project about how that affects the people who need representation. Hi, Tricia.
Hi.
Now let's hear the defender's perspective. Sean O'Brien is with us from UMKC's law school. He used to be a public defender. We are unable to speak with the current public defender in Missouri because of a pending lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
How does it make you feel to hear what people are saying about this system and how it sounds like it fails people?
Oh, it's a discouraging occupation. I used to be the chief public defender in this county until 1989.
In Jackson County?
In Jackson County. And what happens when a system is stressed like this one is that you cut corners and then you institutionalize deficient performance. You train lawyers to be incompetent.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
So, for example, you're waiting until right before trial to do your investigation, which essentially makes every prosecution alibi proof. In Ricky's case, every alibi witness was cross-examined about the fact that they were not contacted by a lawyer until a month before trial, a full year after the case. So how do you remember possibly what you were doing on February the 6th, 1996?
But you're saying lawyers are trained to pursue cases that way?
Well, they have to pursue cases that way because it's all about triage. You have to coerce clients to try to plead guilty. There is an institutionalized meet 'em and plead 'em process.
Why?
Because if you don't, you get buried with cases. The other thing that happens, and you know, we're trying to help the defender train its way out of this process. So Tricia and I have been in trainings. My daughter Quinn is a private investigator, and she also participates in these trainings with us. And we're trying to say, you know, the gold standard for investigation, actually not the gold standard, the competent way to do an investigation is face-to-face interviews. And when we explain that you do a face-to-face interview, you go where the witness is, you knock on the door, you talk to them. They don't do that. They pick up the phone and they make a call. So they can't say with any definitive authority that they're actually talking to the person they want to interview. And as far as the person on the other end of the line, they don't know who this is. They don't know you're not a police officer. They don't know you're not another drug dealer. They don't know who you are. And so you don't get information over the phone. And yet, I would say 90% of the investigation in the public defender's office is done over the telephone, and that's the wrong way to do it.
If you were to give like the most basic job description imaginable for what a public defender does, what would be that job description?
Well, you are a lawyer. You are there to advocate for an individual who is accused of a crime. That means that your job is to do an independent investigation, not rely on the police reports, but to go out in the field and make sure the government has the evidence it says it does. Find counter evidence if it exists. In the process of finding out what really happened, then you can adequately advise your client about whether this is a case we should negotiate, this is a case that's been overcharged, there are some legal issues in the case about the legality of the search, whether or not the interrogation process was proper and produced reliable evidence. And what are your defenses so that the defendant can make a fully informed decision about whether to, you know, plead guilty, plead not guilty, go to trial, and then at trial be able to present evidence that is that has integrity, that has been explored, that can support the client's side of the case. And if you don't do that, then essentially we have a one-sided system. I call it an economic presumption of guilt when you don't fund a system that can do those things. What I used to tell my assistant defenders is that you're just like a private lawyer. Lawyers are obliged to give their best to every single client, represent every client like he or she is your only client. And lawyers are prohibited from allowing the interests of the person who's paying the client's fee, if it happens not to be the client, from interfering with how you represent the client. And so the big ethical dilemma for public defenders is, do you placate the interests of the state when they're contrary to those of the client because the state's paying your fee? Absolutely not.
Why does the state have an interest in an individual's guilt or innocence at all? I mean, it would seem to me that the state would have the biggest interest in the fairness of the process.
You would think that that would be the case. Unfortunately, there is this attitude that we need to put people in prison. There is a real thing, I believe, an economic presumption of guilt that poor people, if you're charged with a crime, you must be guilty. Our system is not funded consistently with a presumption of innocence. In fact, it's exactly the opposite.
What made you want to become a public defender?
It was copacetic with my values as a lawyer. Lawyers are obliged to make sure that justice is available to everyone. We have a monopoly on access to the justice system. And if you just took a general poll of Americans, and you know, whenever I talk to a group in public, I'll ask, how many people think it takes money to get access to justice in America? Every hand in the room will go up, right? None of my clients have ever had any money. And so the only way you can make the system work for someone like that is with a vigorous system, a robust system of indigent defense, people who are dedicated to enforcing the Constitution, to social and economic justice, and to criminal justice.
Would you say that there's a public defender type?
Yes, I would. I would.
Can you describe it?
It's a person who cares about justice, but also cares about people, sees humanity in their clients, who looks at a client, accepts the client the way he or she is, doesn't feel that you have to change that person in order to be an advocate for that person, but somebody who cares about fairness. And every public defender I know who sticks with it over a career, you see things that are done broadly in society that affect people's life trajectories in a negative way. So, for example, right now in America, if you look at the numbers regarding mental illness, you would very soon come to the conclusion that the criminal justice system is the primary means of delivering mental health services to poor people. And that's a true statement. I've not talked to anybody who can refute that. And that's just wrong. You know, we wait for people to commit a crime that is actually a behavioral symptom of mental illness before we start concentrating mental health services on that person. Over 60% of the people who are incarcerated in America today are on psychiatric medication. I mean, that's just remarkable. And that's dangerous to society. And there's so many things that we do and we don't do that actually makes society less safe, less healthy. And eventually you come to the conclusion that what we need to do more of in America is look at some of these behaviors, particularly in young people, as a health problem as much as a criminal justice problem.
So what was your favorite part of the work, just the process of being a public defender?
Boy, there's so much of it that I really loved. One piece of it, the people I work with. You know, public defenders are the finest lawyers in existence. They want to do better work than they're doing, and a lot of them burn out because they know they're not doing right by their clients. And so being, you know, part of that community, public defenders are also civil rights lawyers. You know, they, you know, see the problems of racism and implicit bias in the criminal justice system, and they want to do something about it. Systemic reform, being able to take on issues. When I was the public defender, one of our biggest problems were that prosecutors could and would eliminate people of color from petit juries just because they could. There was no law that prohibited from doing that. So I was a lawyer for 10 years before I looked at a jury box and saw a black face in it. Wow. In Jackson County. And that was devastating to me. But we worked really hard to get to the point where it was recognized as unconstitutional for prosecutors to do that.
It sounds to me like when you describe what motivated you to do the work and what it sounds like motivates a lot of people to do the work, it sounds to me like that would be really unbearable for that personality to be in the situation that we've described of not having the time or resources to dedicate to each and every case. How do people deal with that?
Often they leave. It is why I left. In 1989, they reorganized the public defender system. And one of the things that I did as the chief defender, when our caseload got above 30 cases a lawyer, I would go to the presiding judge in the county and I would say, we can't take any more cases because our lawyers are overloaded. And the presiding judge would take the less serious felonies, C and D felonies, and assign them to private lawyers in the big firms in Kansas City. And the firms would agree to accept those cases on a pro bono basis. And they would do that for a period of time until we got our caseload back under control and we would begin taking cases again. That's not an ideal system, but it was an essential safety valve. And I left the public defender system in 1989 because I was told by the new administrator that we were prohibited from doing that. And my response was, you can't ethically do this job if you can't do that. And so I left, and then that safety valve went away until it was attempted to be revived a little more recently, and there's been some litigation about it. But it's not being relied upon. So I thought that 30 cases a lawyer was too many. I talked to a lawyer the other day who has 120 cases. That's absurd.
I mean, you've talked about triage being part of the job. What does that mean? How do you prioritize? Is that prioritizing one case over another?
It is. It is a lawyer doing what lawyers ought not to do. This client seems guilty to me. I'm not going to check out his I'm not going to let him send me on a wild goose chase. I'm going to look at this other guy who I think is innocent. And you make choices about how you spend your time. So if you've got 120 clients and you've got an eight-hour day, you pick and choose how you're going to spend your time that day. And it's only going to be for one client or maybe two clients. But that means you've chosen 118 clients who are not getting legal services on that day.
As a professor of law, how do you advise future public defenders knowing all of this, knowing about the tough ethical calls people are going to have to make?
I try to send my students into good places. There are good defender systems outside of Missouri. There are really good nonprofit firms like the Midwest Innocence Project is a great place. I'd love to place students in Tricia Bushnell's
office. Do you discourage people from becoming public defenders?
Yes, I do. It pains me to say that, but I have a couple of different lectures that I give to students when we're talking one-on-one. And it depends very much on the student. Some students, I've told, this job would destroy you. You shouldn't do it. Other students, I've said, you know, you've got the talent. You could do this job, but here are the things that you need to be prepared to do. The thing about a public defender in a system in crisis, the American Bar Association has a protocol for defender systems in crisis, and I train students on what that protocol is. I make sure that they've read it, that they understand that they have not just a right, but an obligation to say, no, this next case you want me to take is one case too many. And so every problem that a criminal defendant could face, an overworked attorney, lack of access to money for investigation, every one of those is a constitutional right that can be litigated and enforced. And so I make sure that students know that here is the toolkit of constitutional rights that you can use for your clients. And as long as you're committed to use that toolkit and you have the skills and the will to do it, and you're not afraid to lose this job for doing it, then you can be a public defender.
Well, if you have a question about the causes and repercussions of stretched resources in Missouri's public defender system, call 816-235-2888. Trisha Bushnell of the Midwest Innocence Project, as someone who works to exonerate people wrongly convicted of crimes, does any part of you feel compassion for public defenders who just don't have resources to give people the representation and the defense they deserve?
Absolutely. You know, Sean was talking about the profile of someone who goes into the public defender system. These are folks who care. These are people who want to do a really good job. And it's the system that's not letting them do it. So, you know, their inadequate representation that occurs, it isn't always their fault. But the difference and something that we try to train public defenders to do and to understand is they need to put it on the record. They need to tell the judge, I cannot do this. I need funding for an investigator. I need funding for this time. Because then when the judge denies it, it becomes a due process issue that the court would not allow them what they needed to have a fair trial. But if the public defender just doesn't ask, if they don't put it on the record, then it becomes about their representation and their ability to do something. And so that, I think, is the biggest thing. When folks talk about what we do, we have to explain that it was someone's fault why this trial went wrong. And often we're saying it's either the prosecutor or the defense attorneys. It can also be the systems. But in order for it to be the systems, they have to make a record of why that's happening.
This might sound crass, but why, if a person's sitting out there listening who has never been charged with a crime and never expects to be charged with a crime, what is that person's stake in any of this?
Well, it's actually a very large stake. One thing I think people don't appreciate is your rights, the protections, the laws, the way that courts decide cases and make rules about what rights you have, they are decided by the cases public defenders bring. Now, that means when a guilty person's rights aren't protected and you're the innocent person who finally gets picked up, your rights are no longer protected because we've decided case law based on what came before.
Can you explain that? I'm not sure I totally follow.
Yeah, so what happens when we make laws? So laws can happen in statute, right? That when the legislator passes it. But law is also made in how courts interpret those statutes or courts interpret the Constitution. And the judge issues a ruling from the bench and the appellate courts issue these rulings and those become the law. What constitutes a fair search, right? That's what the courts decide. We think about the U.S. Supreme Court when they make these new rules or they enforce or change and augment rules. The cases that come before them are heard by the cases that public defenders are bringing. They're the everyday cases. They're saying, you know, this is the right that someone has, and it's often the right of a guilty person being represented by a public defender that you will want vindicated when it's your shot when you're up there.
We have to take one more short break. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear from someone with the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about stretched resources in Missouri's public defender system. Our guests are Tricia Bushnell of the Midwest Innocent Project and Sean O'Brien with us from UMKC's School of Law. Now I'd like to introduce Tony Rothert. He's the legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
You all have filed a lawsuit against the state. What prompted that litigation?
Well, under the Constitution, if you're accused of a crime, you have the right to an attorney, even if you can't afford one. And that's what keeps the system fair. It's been apparent for some time now that in Missouri, Missourians have public defenders in name only. There have been efforts over the years to increase funding, to restructure systems so that public defenders will have the time and resources to provide adequate representation. And all those efforts have failed. So we're challenging the system under the Constitution. It's really a last-ditch effort because Missouri's government itself has not fixed its system.
What are some of the efforts that have failed? Can you tell me about those?
Yes, there have been efforts to increase funding, even a little bit. The legislature, not this past year, but the year before, increased funding to the public defender system. Yet when it got to the governor, those funds were withheld. There have been efforts through cases challenging the caseload numbers to give public defenders the right to refuse cases when their caseloads are too large. But for largely political reasons, that's not effective either. That hasn't helped reduce numbers.
What political reasons?
Well, it's very hard for a lawyer to say to a judge, no. A public defender to say to a judge, no, I'm not taking another case, or even the things that Tricia was speaking about earlier, making the judge say no and demanding a ruling on whether or not you get an investigation. That's a difficult thing for an already busy lawyer to do because it puts the judge in a spot that he or she does not want to be in. And, you know, this is a judge you're appearing in front of and trying to get good results for your other clients. So it just adds to the difficult position that public defenders are in.
Is what is going on in Missouri unique, or is this something that you see kind of analogous situations to in other states?
Missouri is not the only state that inadequately funds public defenders, but we're bad. We're second from the bottom, 49th out of 50 states, in how much we spend per capita on public defense. And we spend a third per capita on public defense of what the average amount is in other states. So it's the state's job to fund critical functions of government, like public defender systems, and Missouri is uniquely failing.
If you were to, look within the system and say, everyone here has made the case that it's underfunded, you can't just do more when you don't have the resources. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the system, the public defender system within the state, has options that it hasn't leveraged?
I'm not sure the public defender system itself has options. It's limited by how much money it has. The Public Defender Administration in recent years, they've tried many different ways to get some relief for their caseloads, including, trying to appoint the previous governor to take a case. Creative things. The state, though, can do a lot. As Sean O'Brien was mentioning earlier, if we did mental health treatment earlier, there would be less people arrested for crimes and fewer people needing public defenders, which would reduce caseloads. If we had fewer prosecutions, because we decriminalized marijuana, for instance, there would be fewer criminal defendants needing public defenders, which would reduce caseloads. If we focused more on restorative justice and diversion rather than putting people in prison when it wasn't necessary to do so, fewer people would be entitled to a public defender, and that would help reduce caseloads. So there are any number of things we could do.
The caseload is not just about funding, but it's about how criminalized various activities are.
That's absolutely true. One of the reason this problem has gotten worse and worse and worse in Missouri is not only are we not keeping up with funding public defenders, but we are increasing the number of cases that are brought. So the demand is not only is the supply of attorneys going up, but the demand for public defenders is also going up. The supply and demand are out of whack, and that's just going to make caseloads continue to grow and this problem to get worse.
So when people talk about like getting tough on crime, is this part of that? I mean, there are a lot of cases and that the system has to absorb those somehow.
Right. Getting tough on crime sounds nice, but it comes with a cost. If you're going to have more cases, then you have to spend the money to provide public defenders. We also have a mass incarceration problem in Missouri and across the country that's costing money too because of the idea of getting tough on crime. The idea of putting people in jail is not free.
Speaking of which, I have heard that part of what's going on here with the workload of public defenders is that there are people sitting in jail just waiting to meet their lawyers.
Right. So, it's not uncommon, in our case, our clients in that case are pretty representative of what happens. But people, even innocent people, sit in jail for months waiting to see their lawyer. And public defenders don't have time or resources in many places across the state to be able to help with bail hearings, to have people to have an opportunity to get out of jail while their case proceeds. And if you're sitting in jail waiting, you're more likely to take a guilty plea, whether you're innocent or not.
Tricia, is that something that you have seen a lot of?
Yeah. So the statistics, we know that when we think about innocent folks, people have a hard time imagining that they would plead guilty, but that's actually exactly what happens. There's a number of people who plead guilty, and the lower the offense, the longer that someone's waiting, with the lower the offense, the more likely they are to plead guilty. We don't talk about misdemeanors at all, for example. How many folks are taking a plea to, a little time in jail or a fine in order to get out and get home and keep their job and be with their kids versus to have the truth come out?
You know, Sean O'Brien, I'm curious. Earlier you said that you advise law students, certain law students with, maybe bleeding hearts, not to become public defenders. What would it take for you to change that advice?
It would take a better systemic protection of clients and lawyers. Right now the system is just overwhelmed. One of the studies in the Missouri Defender System said that the system has been so overwhelmed for so long that there's almost nobody left who knows how to practice law. You want to send a new lawyer into an environment where there's going to be meaningful mentorship. And so I find myself counseling lawyers or young lawyers, graduating law students, into nonprofit law firms, because I know that in a place like Equal Justice Initiative or the Southern Center for Human Rights or the ACLU, that they're going to be given a caseload they can handle, mentorship, and they'll be working with high-quality, dedicated professionals. And I wish that were true across the board of the defender system. And there are different offices that have different cultures. And so I do counsel students into some Missouri Defender offices and not into other Missouri Defender offices. It's a difficult position to be in.
Tony Rothert from the ACLU, what would you have to see to make you think maybe things are turning around in Missouri?
Well, I think, some concrete step from the state to make the system better. The easiest way would be some meaningful increase in funding.
Well, Tony Rothert, thank you so much for joining us from the ACLU of Missouri this morning.
Thank you.
Sean O'Brien, former public defender with us from UMKC School of Law, thank you.
Thank you.
And Tricia Bushnell of the Midwest Innocence Project, it's been good seeing you today.
Thank you.
Our time is up, but you can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can listen to all of the shows that we have on this program while you're there. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. Linda Scher runs the board for us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.